And welcome. So this is another series that we are running called Equisitive. So it's about really trying to find answers to some of the questions that we may have. When they gave out the topics, I drew the short straw, I'm afraid, which is the following: if God is so good, why is there so much suffering in the world? So it's probably one of the most frequently asked questions of Christians, and probably one of the most frequently raised objections to the Christian faith. So I suppose I ought to state my position, which is I will obviously be coming from a Christian perspective on this. Can you hear?
Does everybody know who he is?
Oh, sorry.
Would you give just
30 seconds
on that. CV, please. Yeah. CV, a brief, succinct version. Yeah, my name's Peter, and I came into the ministry quite late. Actually, I took early retirement from the NHS some time ago, and, years ago, actually, I felt a call to the ministry, but then I took a fairly lengthy route, and eventually, a couple of years ago, began training for the ministry, and here I am. So I've been here a couple of months with Home Eden and Wetherall Churches. So previous to that, I did social sciences, then became a psychiatric nurse. I then worked in Nepal. I was just speaking to you about that, and established HIV programs in Nepal for about 6 years. Took my family there. Then I worked in various refugee programs in Africa, and then eventually came up to Cumbria and worked as a clinical director in a drug and alcohol directorate. So, and then took early retirement from the NHS, which is not the easiest place to be working in these days, is it not? So, anyway. Hope that answers your question. Thank you.
And he isn't here to replace Graham. He's here to support our minister. Is here to support him. That was the one vital bit of information.
No, I wouldn't think of replacing Graham.
But he is today.
So, suffering. We see suffering on a global scale. There are natural disasters, earthquakes, famine, disease, floods. And the suffering that results is often pervasive and arbitrary. So the two world wars, for example, last century, really focused our attention on global suffering in a very acute way. And even today, well, apart from the major wars, even now we're aware of wars somewhere or other raging in some part of the world. So we also see community tragedies. One of the worst in Britain was in 1966, which was some of you may remember, the Aberfan disaster, which is where a huge coal tip devastated a primary school, killing 116 children and 28 adults. So almost daily we hear of disasters, planes crashing, ships sinking, and you only have to mention place names to evoke unspeakable acts of evil. Place names like Rwanda or New York, Germany, and many more. So the attack on the World Trade Center, for example, killed 3,000 innocent lives and 346 firefighters, and seemed to shake the very foundations of not only New York at the time, but the whole world. So suffering comes in an endless variety of forms, through bereavement, sickness, disease, broken relationships, broken marriages, depression, anxiety, unemployment, and so on. I want to look at, or start by looking at, other religions. Suffering is not such a problem for other religions. It is, though, a very acute problem for the Judeo-Christian perspective, because we believe in a God who is good and who is all-powerful and almighty. So that gives us a unique problem. C.S. Lewis put it in this way when he stated the opposing argument. If God were good, he would wish to make his creatures perfectly happy. And if God were almighty, he would be able to do what he wished. But the creatures are not happy. Therefore, God lacks either goodness or power or both. So that is the problem of pain, stated in its simplest form, really. I might seem to be confident in trying to give a Christian response to this rather difficult question, but I don't want you to be fooled. The question troubles me quite a lot, really, and I don't purport to have all the answers by any means. I'm not sure that the Bible answers all the questions on the topic of suffering, but I do think it probably gives us the most incomplete response to the question of pain. I hold to the biblical perspective because that's a perspective that does give some answers, and that's why it's important to look at other perspectives found in other religions and other philosophies. So I want to take just a few slides just to look at other religions. So let's begin with Hinduism. You may already know that Hindus believe that all the events in the universe are regarded as karma. It's the divine principle of balance in the cosmos, the principle that matches your deeds with very specific outcomes, whether they're the deeds of this life or of a previous life, which taps into their doctrine of incarnation. You basically reap the consequences in this life. For example, a family who loses a child sincerely believes that it is reaping the consequences of its action from either this life or from a previous life. Or a businessman, as he walks down the street, sees a beggar in the road. However much he might feel compassion for that person, he'll perceive that that person is reaping the consequences of his or her karma. Therefore, Hinduism has a very clear and a very comprehensive response to the question of suffering. Suffering within Hinduism is rationalized as a divinely sanctioned balance. Oops. Talk about Buddhism. It arose as a direct response to the problem of pain and suffering. It is all about suffering, in fact. Siddhartha Gautama was a prince around 500 BC, and he lived a life of luxury until he was about 29 years old, when he ventured outside his palace and encountered untold suffering. So he returned to the palace determined that one day he would find a solution to the problem of suffering. He left his wife and his newborn baby and spent 7 years in rigorous denial of himself, and also gave a rigorous treatment to his own body in ascetic denial, until he discerned the answer through meditation to his question. He received his enlightenment after 7 years, and from then on was known as the Buddha, or the Enlightened One. The Buddha had come to believe that suffering is an illusion, and there are apparently four noble truths in Buddhism. The second one is that suffering arises from desire. For example, the pain of losing a father arises not because of the loss of the father per se, but because of the child's desire for the father's affection. or the suffering of a beggar arises not so much from the circumstances of poverty, so much as the beggar's desire for a better life. If we can remove certain things, like the desire for a better life, then the experience evaporates and therefore no longer causes suffering. So the ultimate goal of enlightenment in Buddhism is to realise the utter oneness of everything, and that's the oneness of everything without any differentiation whatsoever. There is therefore no difference in Buddhism between good and evil. The idea that there is a difference between good and evil in Buddhism is an illusion that needs to be overcome on the path of enlightenment. So Islam is the second world's biggest religion. And Islam has a different response to suffering. Within Islam, all events are determined by the will of God, or the finger of Allah. Every time a war breaks out, or a baby dies, or a plane falls from the sky, it is the finger of Allah. I remember in the Desert War, the Iraqi troops were overtaken by a desert storm and therefore were hidden from the British and the coalition troops. And the Muslims talked about it being the cloak of Allah. Islam understands God as the unmoved mover, a famous phrase which was first coined by Aristotle, but is a viewpoint exemplified in Islamic theology of the Middle Ages, particularly in the Sunni tradition, where it's taught that God moves all things in the universe, but is himself unmoved, or is himself moved by nothing. The reason for events is for the Muslim unknowable, which may sound harsh to our modern ears, but a Muslim would immediately respond by saying that by resigning yourself to the will of God, your meaning as a human being is found within that. The word Islam actually means submission. So a Muslim is one who submits to the will of Allah. The problem of pain, therefore, for a Muslim is therefore unknowable. I thought I'd just touch on the atheist position. In the beginning, there was nothing, the quote has it, and then it exploded. It was actually Jean-Paul Sartre, the French philosopher, who said the problem with atheism is that how can we have something from nothing, which is a tricky philosophical thorny issue. So different to the religious responses is the response of the atheist. The one who rejects the existence of God absolutely and completely. Suffering is not the result of karma, or it isn't the result of the finger of God, but just from the sheer natural forces of the world. For the atheist, there is no design, there's no purpose, there's no grand unfolding story in human history. There's just the intersection of matter and time and space. So for the atheist, there is no God, there is no transcendent realm whatsoever. Reality is nothing more than the sum total of the mass and energy of the universe, plus time, plus space. So human existence is merely the end product of our evolutionary history of gene mutation. I thought I'd give you a quote by the Oxford professor Richard Hawkins. He says, and he has a way with words really, he says, in the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt and some are going to get lucky. There's no rhyme or reason in it, or justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we expect. If there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. So there you go. But for whatever reason, atheism has never actually taken off in the world. Apparently only 4% of the world's population are atheists. So for the atheist, there is no question to ask. In fact, for the atheist, there's no one to ask. So let's, I want to move on to the Christian position. Christianity has, as I said at the beginning, a very different approach. The Bible actually invites us to come and approach God with our questions, our doubts, our complaints, with our suffering, really. Consider Psalm 22, which was written centuries before Christ appeared on the earth. The psalm opens with the saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? If I were a Buddhist, this line of question would be a sure sign of my lack of enlightenment. If I was a Muslim, these words would probably border on blasphemy. And of course, for the atheist, the question is utterly meaningless. So Psalm 22 is more than just shouting at God. It's an invitation for us to actually come and shout at God, to make our complaints to him. And you see that again and again in the Bible and indeed the Psalms. By including the Psalm and many others like it, the Bible takes an approach to suffering quite unlike the approaches of world religion. Our doubts and questions are allowed in Christianity. At the approach of his death, Jesus himself reached out with the very words of Psalm 22 to express what he was feeling. Jesus cried out in Aramaic, which I don't speak, but goes something like this, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? So the God of the Bible bids us to approach him with our frustrations and our doubts and our fears. Whereas in the 21st century, we would ask, people tend to ask the question, why? In the Bible, people would rather tend to ask, how long? How long, O God, is this going to go on for? When is it going to end? Their plea was not to demand that God gave an explanation for the origin of evil, but rather to plead with God to do something to bring evil to an end. And that, we shall see, is exactly what God has promised to do. So, suffering was not part of God's original created order. In dramatic imagery, the opening chapters of the Bible describe the first man and the first woman and how we were given the ability to choose between right and wrong. In other words, we were given free will. It's a function of our very nature. You are free to eat of any tree in the garden. You may not eat from the tree of knowledge and good and evil. So the world portrayed in Genesis 1 and 2 is like a huge triangle of God, the earth, and humanity, and every relationship was spoiled by the invasion of sin and evil. We're told how evil came into the world, but we're not told how evil was created. And that remains a mystery, I'm afraid. So if you do have questions at the end, that's the only answer I can give to that one. But every relationship, as I said, was spoiled by the invasion of sin and evil. The relationship between God and us, the relationship between God and the earth, and the relationship between us and the earth. hence, I mean, we hear a lot about global warming at the moment and the destruction of the earth and the rainforests, etc. So the Bible's diagnosis is very clear and very simple. Sin has invaded every human being. We are all sinners. Sin distorts every dimension of the human personality, whether that be spiritual, physical, mental, emotional, or social. Sin pervades the structures and conventions of human society and cultures. Sin affects creation itself. And this is the human story. The word Adam in the Hebrew is Adama, which means mankind. So we were given the choice to love and obey God and to trust in his goodness and authority. But we were given this freedom from the beginning, but we chose not to do so. This actually begs the question, why doesn't God step in and override our wills if he's almighty? And why doesn't he do that and keep us from inflicting unspeakable harm on ourselves and on one another? Well, I don't have the full answer, but it's interesting to turn the question on its head and say, what sort of a world would it be or situation would arise if God did override our wills at every potentially harmful situation that we came across? Imagine every time you wanted to buy a nice bottle of red wine and you found yourself inexplicably asking for a bottle of water instead. Or if you turned up to a job interview and found yourself singing the praises of the other candidates, we'd be robotic. The question of it being artificial intelligence, I suppose. If this were the case, rather than asking the question, if God is so good, then why is there so much suffering in the world, we'd actually be asking a far more tragic question, which would be, why did God create us without a free will? But in actual fact, such a God wouldn't allow even that question to be asked. So the Christian position is that God is a God who suffers alongside us. John Stott said, I could never believe in God if it were not for the cross. He's not looking on as some kind of impassive observer. God is not immune from suffering. He is not far removed from a suffering world. He is, as someone's, he is, to use somebody's phrase, the crucified God. He became one of us. He suffered in all the ways that we suffer. He doesn't just know about suffering. He suffered himself. He knows what we are feeling when we suffer. In 1967, a beautiful teenager called Joni Erickson had a terrible diving accident at Chesapeake Bay, which left her as a quadriplegic. Gradually, after a very rebellious start and lots of bitterness and anger and despair, she actually came to trust in the sovereignty of God, and she built a new life using her mouth to hold a paintbrush and also to build a new life as a public speaker. And one night, 3 years after the accident, she realised that Jesus empathised with her completely. It had not occurred to her before that on the cross, Jesus was in a very similar pain to hers, unable to move, crucified to the cross, also paralysed. So the question we may want to ask is, what purpose might suffering have? Struggling with the... Whoops, sorry. Thank you. Right, good. What purpose might suffering serve? Sorry about that interlude. Suffering brings home to us the distressing fact of our mortality, I'm afraid, reminds us of our frailty and hints at forthcoming death. In short, suffering creates a climate within which our thoughts are gently directed towards God. C.S. Lewis put it this way: God whispers to us in our pleasure, he speaks to us in our conscience, but shouts to us in our pains. It is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Some say nothing could ever be adequate to recompense for suffering in the world, but how do they know? Have they spoken to anybody who has suffered and died and then returned to tell us, other than Jesus? Paul believed that the sufferings of the present life, and he endured a lot, will be outweighed by the glory to come. The situation would be rather different if we could listen to someone who suffered a painful and a pitiful death, and then that person returns from the dead. He would speak with authority and insight on the matter. And the wonder of the Christian message is that Christ has indeed died and risen again, and God has spoken on such matters. So the sufferings of earth are real, they are painful, but God is deeply pained by our suffering. Faith actually demands that we raise our sights to look at what lies ahead. The word heaven seems inadequate to describe the final goal of faith. The hope of eternal life is the renewing of our frail and mortal bodies in the likeness of Christ's resurrection body. So it's a promise of transformation and renewal. Actually, heaven isn't the final place. Revelation speaks of both earth and heaven being renewed. So just as suffering is real, so are the promises of God. The death and resurrection of Christ, linked with the giving of the Holy Spirit, are pledges and sureties and guarantees that what has been promised will be realised. So I was a bit reluctant to introduce this final slide to the talk, but decided to do so, mainly because it's a central tenet, really, of the Christian faith. And it's a theme. The theme of judgment is a theme that weaves its way throughout the whole of the Bible. We often forget that Jesus actually spoke very clearly about the day of judgment, and he spoke about it more than any other writer in the Bible. John speaks about it in Revelation when he had his apocalyptic vision. But judgment is actually probably something of a misunderstood concept. For all its connotations and associations with Bible-thumping preachers, the concept of judgment is not in the first instance some kind of theological scare tactic to make us more religious. The theme of judgment is God's pledge, really, to humanity, that he sees everything, he knows everything, that all is recorded, and he hears our cries for justice, and that one day God will bring about his judgment to bear on every unspeakable act. So people don't understand that his judgment is actually about his love. It's about the love of God. It's because God loves the victims of the Holocaust, the victims of the people of Rwanda who were massacred, that he will bring judgment. So this is in part why Christians talk so much about the death of Jesus. The reason for this is that he taught that at the moment of his death, he bore the judgment that humanity deserves. And that concludes Inquisitive. It's a huge subject.